Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turfs Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And a pleasant evening to all our listeners, and I hope everybody's doing well, and welcome to the Water Zone. I'm Rob Starr, along with Mr. Chris Davies. And Chris, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Arizona is, I know, 6 hours away by drive time, but somehow today you just seem closer. Rob, why is that?
Well, because I'm only 4.5.
So we're on the same time zone is the right answer, right? So we're now equalized in daylight saving.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad we're back to that. So I don't have to, just every time I got an Outlook message, it would send the message to our server in Riverside. But I'm in Arizona, so it shows the California time and not the Arizona time. So when I get on the air to go do it, I'm an hour early all the time. So now that's all fixed, so I'm happy with that.
Yeah, that's okay. Hey, last week, take it on. We just told dirty jokes for an hour, and it was fine.
Yep. I do want to apologize to all our listeners for the last couple of weeks. We had some technical problems developing with the connection lines, and hopefully they're all resolved today. And we shouldn't see those or hear those anymore. We start talking in the show and then we get cut off. We try to dial back in and we can't get in. So I know there's been a lot of aggravation and disappointment on your end and our end. And hopefully we between us and our technical staff, we got that all completed. So again, we'll take our apology and we're going to try never to have that happen again. So it's beyond our control, but we'll just try to manage it as best we can. So. That's it. Hey, Chris, you know, our industry, both for the irrigation, lighting, and landscaping, the IA, which is the Irrigation Association, they're telling us, don't miss your opportunity and chance to show off for Irrigation and Green Industry Magazine's new Changing the Landscape Awards. And they're looking for amazing projects done in the past 2 years by any landscaper, irrigation professional across 3 categories, both landscape design, irrigation, and lighting. And the award spotlight works that took on difficult obstacles or produced outstanding results. So that's something they want to do. Each winner will be the focus of an in-depth feature article in an upcoming Irrigation and Green Industry news magazine. And it's going to show what makes your work stand out and submit your project by March 29th to www.ign.com/CTIAwards. I'll repeat that, www.ign.com/CTL Awards. And the CTL Awards are sponsored by the Ditch Witch Company, which is part of the Toro Company, Dawn Industries, and Brilliance LED. So that's a good thing for any of our listeners who are in those industries and want to get featured and win a nice award. So please take them up on it. It's a great opportunity to tell people what your organization or you personally have done to make something better. So that'll be good. I know all the awards that the IA does is more than pretty good. It's excellent. And they always have great winners in different categories. In fact, we won for the show a couple of years back for innovation for doing the radio shows. Yes, we're very proud of that. And we also had some people within our company, Inge Biskoner, a couple of years back, also won an award for things on ag, and so again, we're very proud of that, and we want to help promote anybody in those industries to step up and get recognized and get the recognition that you should get. And you can get more business and get widely known. So anyway, that's a quick word from the Irrigation Association. So any other business news? Yes, sir.
Yeah. So just speaking of events, I don't know if you're allowed to, but can you give a little preview to our listeners of what will be happening with the Weiland Foundation in Toro in a couple of weeks?
Ah, absolutely. It will be on the 1st of Thursday. And what it is the Weiland Foundation, which Toro is a sponsor, and so are we're part of that because of the radio show. They're kicking off this year's National Mayor's Challenge for Water Conservation, and it's going to be in Sarasota, Florida, which I'm going to be heading out there to do. They're going to have Governor Ron DeSantis, the mayor of Sarasota, a bunch of state assembly members and such, a lot of press, and it's the kickoff this year's challenge for that. Last year, the winner was Sacramento, which two weeks ago, I had a pleasure of being in a virtual press conference, which thanked the people of Sacramento for winning that award. And they actually, Toyota gave them a $45,000 car donated to one of their chosen charities in town. And we thought that was a great thing of them to do. So Toyota will be there, EPA people, a whole bunch of people. And it's going to be a great event. And that night, we're going to be having a special reception where the governor and other dignitaries will be. And we'll have actually Weiland and all those people on air with us to do an interview of the day's event and what's happening with the challenge and how successful that's been for the last couple of years. So stay tuned to that. We'll give you more information about it next week as we get closer to the event. And so that's the update that I got. Chris, anything on your end?
No, I'm so excited about that. You know that last year we were actually, the week before, actually, we were down in Weiland's place in Laguna Beach, and we did a live show from his studio right there. Do you remember that?
Absolutely. And that was great. And Weiland was a very gracious person. If anybody hasn't met him, he's an unbelievable person. He's just like the guy next door, but a brilliant artist, famous artist. He also got named by the United Nations to be the official painter of the Olympics that's coming up. So he's very proud of that. And I'm also working. He asked me to work. I don't know how many people know. He has a record company. And, you know, why does a painter have a record company? He likes blues. He has a deal with Sony Music. And he writes words to music about what's happening with the environment. And he gets all superstars, literally, to play on his record, the CDs for him. And he graciously asked me, would I help him write some music for this year's event? And it's kind of a blues shuffle. So it's an upbeat blues, not a sad you know, thing that I got drunk and my wife left me and any of that. It's going to be a really upbeat thing. And so, blues are typically that. You know, it's a sad thing, but this is not. It's a shuffle, so it's kind of upbeat and pretty nice. And I have pretty much all the basic rhythm sections done. And I have to put now the lead instruments on top, and then I will ship that off to Weiland. And then he has to decide who's going to be the chosen singer or singers for this. And I don't know who that is yet, and but I'll be excited about hearing it is because I'll be doing the mixing for that. So once that's done, we'll play it on the air, and then if people want some copies, we'll let them download it, and it'll be great. So that's just the only news I got going.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I know you hummed a couple of bars of it to me if you remember a little while ago. Didn't play it to me, but it's I thought I caught that it was in an A minor scale, so it is in a bluesy scale. So that's. It sounded good.
Yes. Actually, it was in C minor, but again, I can change that. Well, no, but see, the neat thing about having all the recording equipment here and all the digital synthesizers and such, virtual instruments, I can put it in any key they want. I just change the input to it and say I want it from C minor to A minor to E or to F sharp or whatever, and it automatically does that. So, the reason for that is because whoever is going to sing or the people who are going to sing, I don't know what their range is and what key they like to sing in. So this way, once I know who that is and get with that person or persons, then I can tailor the recording to the proper key for them, and it'll sound great. So I'm looking forward to that. That's fun.
I got some good news. I think Chris is with us. Chris Austin,
hey,
why don't you introduce
I
us?
I know you guys tried to lose me. You tried.
No.
You know, I'm pretty dang plucky, I'll tell you, yeah. Well, you send me a Microsoft Teams invite, so what do? I sign on to Microsoft Teams, and, like, I'm sitting there going, why am I all alone? So.
Well, yeah, the thing is, because we're not doing the video portion, we wanted everybody to call in on the audio portion because, as you know, with all the problems that we've had over the last couple of weeks with the lines disconnecting, And I apologize to our listening audience, and you know, so hopefully we won't have that. The only Only thing that we have to bear is that every week we're going to have a new number and a new access code. So that's beyond me. So just know you don't have to log to Microsoft Teams on the computer. You just dial on the phone numbers that it says for audio only.
Okay, well, now I know.
Yes, you do. Now you're in the know. So what's hot in California that's hurting water?
Well, I mean, you know, we can always talk about the ongoing dry conditions, and we don't have a lot of water in the reservoirs. Like Lake
Rising seas.
Huh?
You got rising seas. You got rising seas and warming. And a lot of wildfires coming.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been a dry year. We're going to have another big wildfire season, and there's not going to be a lot of water. Like Lake Oroville is only sitting at about a half full, and that's one of the main water projects that serves, 25% of it goes to Southern California, and the rest is, goes to other places. And Shasta and the Central Valley Project reservoirs aren't looking, they're a little bit better, but not much. And so, we are looking at another dry year, and it looks like it might be kind of bad. But it's never over until it's over, and it's not over yet. So really, it's what we have, May 1st or even June 1st. And maybe we'll have some late storms, come in, hopefully, but I wouldn't count on it. It really looks like the jet stream skewed way north, and Oregon and Washington got all our snow. We should, go make them give it back. But
I heard Denver got 5 feet of snow the other day.
Oh, yeah, they had record snow there, which makes things possibly better in the Colorado River Basin. But, the thing is that there's a lot of factors now that are affecting the snow, particularly in the Rocky Mountains. One of them is, you hear from time to time these major dust storms that they have in Arizona. I think they call them I don't know the word.
They're called Habu. Uh-huh. It's called Habu. Habu.
Yes. And when, here's the thing. We all like to think if we don't see it, then it's just out of, it's not here anymore. But, those dust storms blow in Arizona, and that dust goes somewhere. And where it goes is up into the mountains, in the Rocky Mountains, and on the snowpack. And it makes the snowpack darker. And if you all remember from science, sun will absorb into the darker surfaces and make the snow melt faster than if it was white, right? Because white reflects the sun back. It doesn't melt as fast. And there are also conditions that can occur in the natural environment, in the water cycle, snow. We always think of snow melting and then going into the rivers and wherever it goes into the ocean, and then it becomes vapor. But there is an instance where snow can go directly from snow to vapor, and meaning that the snow disappears off the mountain. It does not run into the streams. It goes directly back into the atmosphere.
Sublimation.
They call that sublimation, yes. So, we have these things going on, and they have affected things in the past. And they may, it's only the middle of March, so it could go either way, theoretically, although the longer it goes for us here, not getting any precipitation, the less likely it will be that we're going to get very much or anything that's going to make a difference. But we're not necessarily there yet. And, yes, they've had exceptional weather in the middle of the country, and we'll see how that affects things on the Colorado River. 7 states and a lot of cities depend on that river. So it would be great if it turns out to be a decent water year for those folks that live on the Colorado River.
Well, the only thing I remember from being young was don't touch the yellow snow or the brown snow.
And on that, I'm going to pivot to something completely different, because there was an interesting story that I posted this week that I think kind of shows that, you know, science kind of shows us that sometimes we think that something's going to happen, but that's not the way that it works out. Surprise! And we had one of those. There is an invasive crab, the European green crab, that has been invading coastlines all over the, you know, it's very much prevalent on the eastern coast, and it has now arrived here on the west coast. And so in an estuary in the Bay Area, now it escapes me, by Stinson Beach, I believe it was, they had an explosion of these European green crabs. So they went in and they extensively removed them, and they estimated that they removed 90% of the European green crabs that they found there. And they thought that that would control the problem, but the big surprise was it turned around the next year. The population exploded to over 300,000 green crabs, which was like, you know, 30 times more than what they'd had in the past. And so they really had to look at this and say, well, why did this happen? Why did we remove 90%? Did next year it come back so amazingly strong? And they knew that it had something to do with their eradication efforts, because they were also monitoring similar estuaries in the area, and none of them experienced the same thing. And what they determined was that when they pulled out 90% of those crabs, they removed, you know, pretty much all of the adult crabs, and there were probably some juvenile crabs in those, were probably made up mostly the 10%. But in, you know, the way that the European green crabs work is that the adults eat the younger ones, and that is a part of the population control. So when they removed all the adult green crabs, then the juveniles just went nuts, and their population exploded. So I think this is a really good, you know, so the bottom line is that what they feel that you need to do really with invasive species, and other studies have shown this too, is you're never going to eradicate them. It would be nice if you could, but it's pretty much impossible to do so. But what you can do is you can manage them. And it sort of, you know, points to this idea of what they call functional management, where you kind of figure out what you need to do to keep the population under control, and, you know, but you have to accept that some of these creatures they're just here to stay. And this is
it sounds like the same philosophy they would use for these blooms that are happening in rivers and streams and such as that. Same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's hard to prevent. Just the other control, the algae blooms.
Yeah, and, you know, and algae blooms have, there's a lot of reasons for algae blooms that have to do with things like agricultural runoff, over, you know, too many nutrients in the stream. So, you know, I mean, they have other drivers than invasive species. Invasive species, you know, we're a global world, and we have ships other countries, and they come into, you know, our bays and into our harbors and into our rivers and upstream quite a bit. I mean, this is how the Great Lakes got quite invaded by invasive species from Europe and, you know, wherever, is, you know, these big ships come in to the Great Lakes, and they go all the way in, like, to Michigan. I mean, they're way past the ocean. And they, yeah. you know, they use ballast water to balance the ship, and in that ballast water there are larvae of species that have no predators or other things here, you know, locally. And, you know, so it really is a problem. But we're not going to be able to solve it by, I mean, they have now have ballast regulations, but they've also discovered that sometimes these species cling on to the hulls of the ship as they're, you know, progressing across the ocean. So, you know, there's not a lot to do about that.
No, but like you said, I mean, it's the same strategy. They got to learn to manage it. And because
exactly.
it can't be 100% genetic, you got to put a plan at least to tame it down and temper it. So, no, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's a theology that kind of come into being called reconciliation ecology, which is this idea that, you know, you kind of have to look at all of the critters in your system and kind of figure out how to make it work for who's there, because you're not going to be able to get rid of the ones you don't want, but you can manage the system to benefit the ones you do want and disadvantage the ones you don't want, but
right.
you can't expect that they're going to go away.
No. And you know, I read in your blog today also, you had an article about microplastics in water, and that's getting to be a big thing. And it's the same thing. How do you manage it now? You know, it's a tough world to deal with, but
well,
it all has to be addressed.
You know, oh, yeah. And, I mean, there's this other story that really hasn't hit yet, but it's out there. In doing the microplastic studies, they found a lot of, in the bay, San Francisco Bay, they found these little pieces of black stuff. And they figured out, you know what that is? Those pieces of tires. Mm-hmm. So think about
wow.
it. I mean, you're driving your tires and the tread wears down. Where do you think those tire particles went? I mean, they go somewhere. Everything goes somewhere.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah.
you know, disappear. And where that is going is into our waterways. So, you know, in part into our waterways and other places in the environment. So, you know.
Yeah.
Everything goes.
Well, it's a lot of, yeah, it's a lot of challenges we got to deal with, and it's not an easy job. I know what it has been in California for the last 30, 40 years, but even here out in Arizona, you see the same kind of things everywhere. I mean, it's just new things popping up, and you know, things that nobody thought. You know, I remember, was it in the 50s and 60s? Everybody said, "Go into plastics. That's the business to be in." And we did. The world exploded into plastics. and now we're sorry that we did, and we're trying to find alternatives and things of that sort. So I don't know. I don't know how to handle it. But you're right. You got to put a bunch of smart people together. They got to come up with a plan. They got to implement it and make it happen. So, well, Chris, we're coming up to our commercial break here. We do appreciate you coming on every single week and giving us the latest in what's happening in California. And for our listeners, please go to mavensnotebook.com, become a sponsor, become a subscriber. It's a great way to get the most up-to-date information about California water. And I can tell you, Chris and I on, Chris Davey and I on the Water Zone read this thing religiously every single day. It gives us great insight and things that we miss out on. So we do appreciate it. And Chris Davies always has a statement about your blog about being a Netflix. Chris, you want to talk about it?
Yeah, so the Netflix
you know.
Is your business, right? Whatever you want. And also, you know, subscribe to Maven's Notebook for the price of a cup of coffee per day. You get everything straight from Maven's Notebook right from the source, direct and prompt.
Yes.
do so. As I said, we use it religiously, and it's a great thing. Chris, we thank you very much for joining us today. Hope you and your family are staying safe from COVID, and we will talk to you next week.
All right. Take care, everyone.
See you, Chris.
Thanks. We're going to take a little break for our commercial sponsors, and we'll be right back with our featured guest. So stick around. It's going to be a great conversation coming up.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and 106.5 FM Yucaipa.
Are you looking for a place to buy your landscape and gardening items? Come visit us at Site One Landscape Supply. We offer a large and quality selection of irrigation, landscape, and outdoor living products such as Toro's water-efficient precision nozzles. Site One Landscape Supply has over 30 locations right here in Southern California, and we are the largest national wholesale distributor of landscape supplies in the United States. Site One's knowledgeable and friendly staff is equipped to help you with all your landscape, irrigation, and outdoor living projects. Whether you're redoing your backyard into a drought-tolerant garden or creating a water-efficient landscape for your client, SiteOne has everything you need, including the latest in water-saving technologies, drought-tolerant plants for your yard, irrigation supplies, fertilizer and weed control products, landscape accessories, hardscape products, outdoor lighting, and much, much more. Visit SiteOne.com to find a store near you or stop by today. Site One, we are stronger together.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
KCAA.
All right, everybody.
All right, welcome back to... Go ahead, Chris.
Stepped right on you again, Rob. I'm sorry, buddy.
No, you can't. Again, we can't see each other, so it's not like we're sitting in the studio together anymore. So go ahead. It's all yours.
I stalled a bit, and I'm sorry for that, buddy. But hey, to our listeners, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone. I'm your host, Chris Davey, along with the incomparable Rob Starr here on the other mic. Of course, one stayed away, but still here. So. All right, let's welcome our guest for the second half. Our guest tonight is Madeline Glickfeld. She's the director of the UCLA Water Resources Group for the Institute of Environment and Sustainability, or IOES, if you want to use an acronym. And heaven knows, Rob, we like acronyms, don't we?
Absolutely.
As director of the UCLA Water Resources Group, Madeline facilitates interdisciplinary research and collaborations on research opportunities with over 36 faculty experts on water and all the other centers and institutes that operate across that campus and that intersect with water issues. Madeline also assists facilities in applying their research to improve water sustainability and resilience through collaborations with local, state, and federal policymakers. Madeline also mentors the UCLA Graduate Student Water Resources Group. I'm sure there's an acronym there, but I'm not going to try it. Though that group negotiates or works with graduate and postgraduate students studying in all water disciplines across the entire UCLA campus. In addition, Madeline has followed and reported on responses to the California drought, a very interesting aspect to our show here. Works with the California legislature, state agencies like the Water Resources Control Board, for instance, and other local water agencies. She's also followed and participated in implementing state laws to increase efficiencies in water systems by reducing leaking of those water systems and creating standards for water conservation in business, public buildings, and residences. She's also testified before the California Assembly on a bill to fund critical improvement in community systems. Rob?
Well, a little bit more stuff. She's done research on extremely complex governance of water supplies, water treatment, and stormwater management in Los Angeles County. Somebody let the dogs out. We hear them. Whoop, whoop. Must be a neighbor. Starting as far back as the 19th and 20th century. Show's going to the dogs. What can I say? Anyway, her research is also focused on safe and reliable drinking water in disadvantaged communities in city areas in Los Angeles County and in the small rural communities of the Salinas Valley. Whitfield is also examining the over 200 water systems, and that's a lot in Los Angeles County, looking at the ability of the smaller disadvantaged community water system to deliver safe, reliable water at a price that low-income customers can afford. Ms. Whitfield's public service includes appointed positions to the California Coastal Commission as Assistant Secretary of the Natural Resources Agency and as a member and chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board for 10 years. Under Governor Schwarzenegger and Brown. He currently serves on the Los Angeles County North Santa Monica Bay Watershed Area Steering Committee and is charged with reviewing and recommending grants to improve local water supply while improving stormwater quality and providing other benefits to the community. So, Madeline, welcome to the Water Zone Show.
Well, thank you. Can you hear me all right? Rob?
Very well.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you perfectly.
Great. I was worried that you would never get to talk about the fact that I know something about drinking water, so I'm really relieved that you squeezed that into it.
Good job, Rob.
Hey, what are the questions that we always start off the conversation with? And just background, I mean, you got a super impressive background and everything, and you certainly know the people, the right people in the right industry to do what you need to do. But how did you choose your career to get into this? We always like to start off with something casual about the person we're interviewing.
I chose my career over and over and over again. What I did, I'm a very lucky person. I'm both very curious, and I have had the opportunity to be exposed to a whole series of what I think are the most important issues. So the most important issues that existed when I was a young woman was, could we do a better job of land use planning? And I did that for a while. And then I got very interested in, could we do a better job of conservation of natural land and recreational land? And I spent a lot of time doing that. And then I moved on, during the time I was on the Coastal Commission, I got very interested in watersheds, stormwater pollution, all those things that both pollute our rivers and our lakes and our oceans. And then when I was on the Regional Water Board, my research has always been profoundly affected by what I learned in my volunteer appointment. I started getting very interested in groundwater and the fact that Los Angeles has a lot of it. People think we're a city, an arid desert. We're not an arid desert. And that they also think that every drop we drink comes from 700 miles or more away. And that's not true. So then I found out that there are 200 water systems that are all working in the biggest county population-wise in the country. And I thought, why is that? So my curiosity got me here.
Excellent. So to go a little further in what you just said, so how did Los Angeles County, which is the biggest metropolitan area in the United States, end up with so many small systems, some with trailer parks even on their own wells?
Well, it's how they started out. In most metropolitan areas, started out exactly the same. There would be a couple of wells here, or everybody would have their own well, and then the wells would go dry, and they would want to drill larger, more expensive wells. And so they joined together to create water entities. And the earliest water entities, one of them was called a county water district. Now, the one important thing about that is that it isn't a county water district. It's just called a county water district. Somebody would draw a line on the map, and the people that lived in it would vote to have one, and they would vote in a board of directors. They would drill a well. They would put together a distribution system. The same thing with what's called a mutual water company. It was meant to deal with vacation homes. And what were vacation homes turned out to be real full-time communities later on in Los Angeles County. So we had trailer parks that had their own mutual water company, and we had little housing developments with their own well and their own mutual water company, and they just stayed for 150 years. They just stayed. In other places, they acted to consolidate and create a large water system the way they did in the East Bay of San Francisco. Or on the mid peninsula on the west side of San Francisco Bay, and the city of San Francisco, there are a number of systems in Orange County and a number of systems in San Diego County, but nothing like what we have in this one county.
Well, Madeline, I've got a couple of questions for you. Actually, the first one is just an interest because I mentioned the Water Resources Working Group. In the intro for you, but that group hasn't been around. I mean, it's when was that group established? I mean, I've had a couple of occasions to come across that name over the years in doing research for the show and for my job. So, what was the genesis of that group? And you direct it. How did it start?
It started with the faculty director for the Institute of the Environment being very involved in water, and wanting to start a group that would encourage faculty from across the center to work through the Institute to do multi-interdisciplinary research, bringing law water experts and business water experts and engineering water experts and public policy people and scientists together to do interdisciplinary research. It hasn't been completely successful because it's so much easier for our faculty to get their own research grant money. And these big research grants take a lot of time to put up together, and it takes a lot of commitment. And there's not a lot of incentives for the faculty to do that. But they do come together for educational purposes, they come to me when they want to know who needs their research. They come to me for students to work on their research. And I do run a fairly successful graduate student group, and I will not pronounce the acronym for that name because it's unpronounceable. But I have a truly multidisciplinary group of students who have a deep interest in water in their field and not that many people to talk to about it. So they engage with each other. They take field trips. We bring in speakers. Month and a half ago, we brought in the reporter that did a whole overview on how they discovered that 3,000 barrels of DDT had been put in the ocean that no one knew about until just now, in the mid 1940s and 50s. So we've had a lot of interesting pieces of work, and many of the students have gone on to water careers after being part of that group.
Well, I know for sure that's not a limit of where you're involved. You're involved in lots of other different organizations and agencies, the Trust for Public Land, for example, Green Info Network, and things like that. So wonderful, wonderful work. The next question I want to just kind of go back, because I said I had two, so to be fair. So to go back to what you said in the first in your intro about people thinking that, you know, all the water that people drink in California comes from 700 miles away, and it doesn't. So you're obviously talking about groundwater there. So why is groundwater so, tell our listeners why groundwater is so important in California.
Well, it's important, and it's very nobody can imagine it. They can imagine water they can see. So if I were to tell you that under the San Gabriel Valley, which is a big valley in Los Angeles, there is a groundwater basin filled with gravel, and in the interstices between the gravel, there's enough water in there to fill up Lake Tahoe. It's a huge groundwater basin. 90% of the water, how did it get there? It came from snowpack down the mountains. It came from rain that came in the form of runoff, but mostly snowpack. It was gradually runoff during the summer months, and it would percolate into the ground. And that's how it all got there. So we have, in that area, 90% of the water is local. In further toward the ocean, in what's called the central groundwater basin and the west water basin, serving over 4 million people, they get about 50 to 60% of their water from groundwater. So relatively little of the area outside the city of Los Angeles and a few areas like the Santa Monica Mountains and that don't have any groundwater basins, a lot of the water is local. And it's so important now because of climate change. Climate change is reducing our snow. It's reducing our snowpack, and that means the amount of water that comes slowly down the mountains is not going to be coming that way anymore. It's going to be coming as rain. And less of that gets into groundwater basins from snowpack than snowpack does. So we're going to be really having to capture that rain and actually put it into the ground. But the big problem that we're facing is that we have 100 years of industrial pollution in the upper groundwater basins, whereas the drinking water wells are in the lower groundwater basins, but still dealing with some pollution issues. And if we don't clean up the upper groundwater basins, that water will percolate. The pollutants will percolate down too. So we have a double challenge: to replace our snowpack and to clean up the groundwater basins so that it's safe to drink.
Yeah, well, if you live in San Gabriel Valley or Western Inland Empire, as I do, you know the area is littered with percolation basins, the Santa Fe Dam area, Chino Basin. So as a resident, I see that front and center. So I think Rob has a question about maybe you can get us into the subject of water in disadvantaged communities, Rob.
Absolutely. Your work is very interesting to us. And so the question I have is, how many smaller disadvantaged community water systems currently serve water in Los Angeles County, and how many people do they serve? And are they all clustered together, or they're just all over the place?
Well, they're mainly in what I call southern Los Angeles County, in an area that goes from the southeast of the city of Los Angeles, on both sides of the southeast of Los Angeles, pretty much down to the port of Los Angeles, and then east and west of there. There is a concentration of systems there. There's another concentration of systems in the Antelope Valley, and they're very different places. Both of them have different characteristics, of course. And then there's a smaller concentration in the San Gabriel Valley, and then the city of Pomona is a disadvantaged community. Now, what is a disadvantaged community? People really don't like to be told that they live in a disadvantaged community, and that it is where poor people live, and that if they live in the service area of a particular water retailer that only has an average of 60 or 80% of median household income for the state as a whole, that consumer base is considered disadvantaged. And what that means in terms of federal and state law is that they're eligible for earmarked money that's made available just for those communities. There are communities like that all over California, in fact, in every state in the union. Most of them are seen as rural. People still can't get over that Los Angeles has 68 of them with about 250 connections and about a million people being served by them. So that's a lot. In the area that I've put the most work into recently, they are all clustered together in southern Los Angeles County, whereas in the Antelope Valley, they're spread out all over the place.
Yeah, I think a recent newsworthy and probably recognizable water district that was in the news was Sativa County. Very small water system, right, served a poor community, Compton and adjacent Willowbrook area. That water system, as many of us know, if we listen to the news, was dissolved in 2019 and taken over by the county. There's got to be a story behind that. So can you tell us why that happened?
Well, first of all, it's not only why it happened, but why it didn't happen sooner. These systems are not visible. People don't know who serves them water, especially in poor communities. If they're a renter, they may not get a water bill. They don't know who is supplying them with water. If you do a survey in Los Angeles about who supplies who they think they get water from, they think they get it from the L.A. Department of Water and Power, the city of Los Angeles, which does serve 4 million people, but not the other 6 million people in Los Angeles. So Sativa is one of those districts that's called a county water district, but is actually a very small area, a part of Compton. Compton has 4 different water entities. That's how we're starting to get the idea of how small these are. And then there's Willowbrook, which is one of the most impoverished places in the southeast. They have 1,650 of these connections there, and they have a flat water rate of around $64 per 1,200 acre feet, except